which is incredible to think the amount of challenges these patients had in their lives.
I think these new therapies will be a huge change in the natural history of C3 glomerulopathy.
Almost every discovery that we have made in medicine is dependent on fundamental discoveries in the laboratory.
Kidney diseases are so highly variable, and it's often very difficult for a clinician to predict which patient will progress to kidney failure.
Welcome to the ASN Kidney Translation Podcast. In this episode, we'll be covering episodes focused on glomerulonephritis. I'm happy today to have one of the first authors on a CJSN manuscript titled C3 glomerulopathy recurs after kidney transplantation in serial biopsies performed within the first 2 years after transplantation. We have the first author here today, Dr. Blanca Tarragon. Thank you so much for joining ASN Kidney Translation.
First of all, thank you so much for inviting me. I'm thrilled to be here. My name is Blanca Tarragon, and I am a Spanish nephrologist. I work right now at Fundación Jiménez Díaz in Madrid, Spain. And I also had the immense privilege of these past couple of years working at Columbia University as a research fellow at the Glomerular Center, where I was lucky enough to participate in very interesting projects such as this one that we are about to discuss.
Thank you so much for joining us. It is a very exciting time for C3 glomerulopathy and for the field of nephrology in general. We currently now have two approved therapies, iptacopan and pegcetacoplan, in the United States, which is just really a phenomenal thing. And I can't say enough, when you see these patients prior to this, there wasn't much we could do. And now we can really change their disease course. So let's talk about this paper here. And obviously, many of these patients with C3 glomerulopathy end up needing a kidney transplant. So tell us about this study and what really preceded it and why you decided to get involved.
So you are very right. These are very exciting times for this ultra-rare disease, granted, but I think this is still very interesting for the scientific community. This study was already in the making when I got there to Columbia University. As you may know, Columbia has a C3 glomerulopathy registry that they have been working on and publishing on for some years now. And their experience was that they were seeing all these patients getting kidney transplants, and not really to their surprise, they were finding that most of them were recurring. So they really wanted to get the message across of these patients have very, very high possibilities of recurring after transplant. And they work really closely with their pathologists to make these recurrence diagnoses. So that's what they wanted to, that's the picture that they wanted to paint with this study.
Maybe we could just take a step back and just talk about what is C3 glomerulopathy and dense deposit disease?
It is a disease that's based on an alteration of the alternative pathway of the complement. And there is an overactivation of this complement pathway, which leads to C3 fragments deposition in the kidneys. And that translates into inflammation of the glomerulus and the glomeruli. And that leads to this disease, which is often leading to end-stage kidney disease in the span of maybe 10 years. Dense deposit disease is one of the two presentations that we classify this disease. There is dense deposit disease and C3 glomerulonephritis. Dense deposit disease is the maybe most known one, or classically known form of C3 glomerulopathy, when it was under the classification of membranoproliferative glomerulonephritis. And in this case, we see those dense deposits on electron microscopy, whereas with the C3 glomerulonephritis, we don't see those super highly dense deposits, but still the light microscopy and the pathogenesis behind it is pretty much the same.
These are young people that get this, which also means they got a lot of living to do before they end up on dialysis. So they might be diagnosed as teenager or earlier than that, and then eventually go on to need dialysis. So one of the things I always thought was interesting is that majority have an autoantibody to either C3, C4, or C5 nephritic factor, and then also autoantibodies to other parts of the complement system, but some also have genetic mutations. This is sort of a disease that spans pediatrics to adults. Can you tell us what age do these individuals typically need a kidney transplant?
In our cohort, which is very similar to the ones that preceded this study, we had a mean age at transplantation of 30 years old. So that's, as you say, very early in life.
One thing to recognize, although we typically see most of the alterations in the kidney, this is a systemic disease. So getting a new kidney, you still have the same complement alteration.
Yes, it's hardly impossible to get rid of that alteration that you have in your complement system activation.
How did you and your team go about answering this question about how often this recurs in transplant?
So what we did was we took that C3 registry that Columbia University was working on. And we looked at all the patients from 2016 to 2023 received a transplantation, and we looked at how they developed recurrence if they did. We had two very specialized pathologists looking at those biopsies, and they did that in a very rigorous manner. And also using the C3 glomerulopathy histopathology index, they specifically re-looked at these biopsies for this study. So we made sure that all of the criteria were reassessed in order to have the most coherent and really objective, as much as possible, results.
So they're all biobank specimens. So you have everything that you can go back and look at the original stains and everything.
Yes, exactly.
Wow. And look at how many. It was 18, is that right?
Yes, 18.
So 18 over that time period, I guess also reflecting the rarity of this disease.
Exactly. Even though it may seem like very few patients, it's really one of the largest that we have out there.
And maybe you can go through table one and just go through the basic demographics of this cohort.
As we mentioned, we had 18 patients with native kidney failure attributed to C3G. 12 of them were C3 glomerulonephritis, and 6 of them were those dense deposit disease patients. Most of them were male, were white, and the median age at transplant, as we previously said, was 31 years. Pretty notable. 8 of these patients, which is almost half of them, had prior kidney transplantations, so this was their second or even third transplantation that they were receiving. Variants in complement genes and also those autoantibodies were studied in some of them, not all of them. It was not as readily available at all times as it might be now, but we did find that some of these patients did have those variants in complement genes, not as many as you would expect. Only one of the 12 tested patients had a potentially disease-causing variant, what we would call today a pathogenic variant. And in terms of the autoantibodies, 9 of those patients were tested for them, and 3 of them showed some sort of autoantibody. Another driver of this disease can be monoclonal gammopathy, and none of the tested patients had any monoclonal gammopathy that we could find.
I think to note one, multiple transplants, that just shows the challenge in a patient like this. First is young, has a lot of life to live. Recurrence rates are high. The other thing is, even though they had several transplants and also a transplant, then recurrence and a biopsy, they're still 31 years of age.
Yes.
Which is incredible to think the amount of challenges these patients had in their lives.
It's a huge burden for sure, yes.
Now that we sort of understand a little bit about these patients, we can talk about the recurrence rate and how that was determined.
So we found recurrence in almost all of our patients. In 16 out of the 18 patients showed recurrence. And the way that we defined this recurrence in the allograft was a bit tricky. We did not completely abide to the classical definition or criteria for C3 glomerulonephritis and dense deposit disease, because we knew that these patients had already had a C3 glomerulopathy diagnosis, we lowered the immunofluorescence threshold to be a bit more sensitive and to catch those earlier stages of the disease. So instead of using the 2+ intensity on immunofluorescence, we lower that threshold to C3 being only one order of magnitude greater than possible immunoglobulins that could be also found. I think that is a pretty big point in our paper. Because of that higher sensitivity, we could really find those early stages of the disease.
Yeah, it seems like that's a tricky thing when you're looking at just immunofluorescence intensity. It can be a challenge, but it makes sense to lower that threshold.
I have to say that we were able to do that because we were lucky enough to have electron microscopy for all of those index biopsies. So the addition of having electron microscopy on top of those immunofluorescence findings is what really allows you to identify this disease.
Yeah, I'm looking at the EM findings. It looks like almost all had mesangial deposits and then sort of a sprinkling of deposits in other locations. So that can help also guide is like how active is the alternative complement pathway, and also are you seeing deposits that would lend you to think that this is recurring. Curious about what sorts of medications were they on, especially complement inhibitors. My guess is none of these had these newer drugs that seem to have really good effect, like iptacopan and pegcetacloplan, but I'm sure there's probably some getting eculizumab. Can you tell us if those drugs were used in this cohort?
Yes. So at the time of the index biopsy, that is the biopsy where we found the recurrence, only one patient was on eculizumab because it was part of the regimen that he was on prior to the transplantation. And the team decided to keep that patient on the eculizumab at the time of transplant. And after the recurrence diagnosis, during the follow-up period, three more patients got some sort of complement-targeting therapy, another one of those being eculizumab as well, and two other patients were enrolled in clinical trials, so possibly receiving that pegcetacoplan or iptacopan.
Are there any other discussion points you'd want to have about your paper that you want the readers to know about?
I think one of the main takeaways from this study is the real use of protocol biopsies, because almost 40% of the cases were diagnosed with a protocol biopsy. That means that they did not show any kind of clinical presentation of the disease. They did not have proteinuria, hematuria, or an acute kidney injury, or a deterioration in that kidney function, or even low serum C3. So those were patients that we just caught because of those protocol biopsies, because the team knew that this disease pretty much always comes back. They were ready for it, and they performed those protocol biopsies mainly in the first 6 months after transplantation. And that allowed us to catch those recurring cases very early on.
You mentioned C3 levels. So in this cohort, what were the typical C3 level post-transplant?
So we examined three time points. We examined various clinical and serological and histological characteristics at the time of the index biopsy, at the time of the recurrence, also at 1 year and at 2 years after transplantation. So what we saw was that we found low C3 in 36% of patients at index biopsy, so not many of them. And that went up to 50% at year one and the year two time points.
The other thing that's interesting is that you also did transcriptomic analysis, which is taking it to another level. Anything you want to mention about that?
Yes, that was led by our pathologist, Ibrahim Batal. He really wanted to show another way that you could differentiate the C3G recurrence versus maybe some other conditions or some other things that can happen during kidney transplantation. So the pathology team performed transcriptomic analysis, and they did find some differences in the way that C3 glomerulopathy manifested in the native kidney versus other glomerulopathies. But the sample was unfortunately not big enough, and probably the cases were caught at a very early stage, and it was not like prominent enough to show those differences in the allografts.
Congratulations on an amazing paper. And I want to sort of speculate and think about the future. What is the future of transplantation in C3G in now a new era of these new targeted drugs to the complement cascade?
I think these new therapies will be a huge change in the natural history of C3 glomerulopathy in the allograft, for sure. For now, I think that we will be able to only limit their use to cases where we, at some point after transplantation, get to see the recurrence. But I think that the real future is in maintaining these complement therapies at the time of transplantation. In that way, we can ensure that the actual pathogenesis of the disease is taken care of at the time of transplant. And that is what really would make a difference in the natural history.
Yeah, more and more, it looks like these are lifetime therapies for these patients. Exactly. It may be the next study, they'll be, instead of 31, 61. Or 71, and that will be really impressive.
That would be wonderful.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Excited to see the future of C3 glomerulopathy. And again, congrats to you and your team.
Thank you so much again for having me.
Welcome to the ASN Kidney Translation Podcast. Today, we'll be talking about a JASN article titled Podocyte-Specific Deletion of STAT3 in KLF4-related experimental podocytopathy. We have the senior author, Dr. Sandeep Malapatu, with us today. Can you please introduce yourself?
Thank you for the invitation. My name is Sandeep Malapatu, professor of medicine at Stony Brook University.
This is a really interesting article, and we have a lot to digest here, being this is a basic science paper, but the underlying principle that we're going to talk about is podocyte stress or death leading to a reaction that we often see as a crescent formation. And it seems a lot of this is driven by this transcription factor, STAT3. And I know you've done a lot of work on this area, and also we need to learn about KLF4 and what that is. So give us a brief overview of where this research started, and then we'll dive a little bit more into the actual background of this manuscript.
Podocytes, as many of us know, are terminally differentiated cells. So they have really minimal, if not no capacity for regeneration. So you're born with all the podocytes you have. Once you lose them, it causes podocyte hypertrophy, remaining podocyte hypertrophy, and subsequently leading to glomerular sclerosis. At times, you can get these neighboring parietal epithelial cell activation and form what you call a pseudocrescent in some diseases versus a crescentic lesion. What we observed a number of years ago is that the deletion of a critical pro-differentiating factor called Krupp-like factor 4, or the Yamanaka factor, which is critical for cell differentiation, is really required for podocyte homeostasis and health. So deletion results in re-entry of the podocyte into the cell cycle via the activation of dysregulated STAT3 signaling and leading to mitotic catastrophe. This subsequently results in neighboring parietal epithelial cell activation due to ligand receptor crosstalk.
So the Krupp-like 4 factor, or the Yamanaka factor, is just a critical transcription factor that regulates many different genes. Primarily, it's during development that it's activated, is that right?
Correct. It's induced expression is induced early in development and is required for cell or podocyte differentiation. Loss of KLF4 early, what happens in this setting is that you start seeing or observing slow activation. Typically, KLF4 works as a negative feedback to keep dysregulated STAT3 signaling activated. So meaning it blocks its activation and subsequently keeps the cell, preventing the cell from re-entering the cell cycle, keeps it in a dull differentiated state. When it's deleted or lost in the adult state, then you have this aberrant activation of STAT3.
So it sounds like KLF4 is kind of a break, basically, in the adult. So it's increased expression, diminishes STAT3 so that you don't have a lot of activity happening with those cells.
Correct, because there are a number of ligands that can activate STAT3 signaling. And so keeping the activation in check is a critical role of KLF4 in the adult podocyte.
Tell me about some of the earlier studies deleting KLF4 in these mice or the Yamanaka factor.
Sure. And just to set the stage, the reason it's called the Yamanaka factor is it's one of the four transcription factors critical for pluripotency in generating the iPS cell, which was awarded the Nobel Prize to Dr. Yamanaka, and hence the Yamanaka factor. What our work previously showed is that using a conditional knockout system, meaning deleting KLF4 only in the podocyte, resulted in initial podocyte injury and loss starting at about 7 weeks of age in the mice. And subsequently, you have rising proteinuria leading to glomerular sclerosis, neighboring pariepithelial cell activation with pseudocrescent formation. Subsequently, 50% of the mice die by about 12 to 16 weeks of age. And so it's suggested that podocyte, just purely the loss of KLF4 in podocyte, resulted in this phenotype. So that's the first phase of the work. The second phase that we demonstrated is that this podocyte loss, the mechanism by which podocyte loss occurred, is that the loss of KLF4 prevented this check on the activation of STAT3 signaling, so allowed for STAT3 to be aberrantly activated. One of the mechanisms downstream of STAT3 activation is inducing reentry of cells to go into the cell cycle. So what we observed is podocytes transition or get activated in the cell cycle, but they're unable to complete the cell cycle, and they detach from the basement membrane, undergoing a process we call as mitotic catastrophe.
I want to go back a little bit to these crescents. You mentioned two terms, pseudocrescent and then crescent. And the Science Advances paper that you and your group published really was an eye-opener to me, because when I first thought about this term pseudocrescent, and in the literature, it was thought these were potentially podocytes that were proliferating, whereas in the crescents, it's a parietal epithelial cells. But what you showed and your group showed is that these were actually all parietal epithelial cells. Can you talk a little bit more about the differentiation between a pseudocrescent, a crescent, and then what are the cells that make up both of those?
In this particular scenario, in this model where you're developing these, initially we characterize as just glomerular epithelial cell proliferation, this extracapillary proliferation. So what we had shown to demonstrate that these are primarily prior epithelial cells in this crescent, or a pseudocrescent in this case, is the fact that we did this lineage tracing study to only label the podocytes with a marker, RFP, or red marker. And to demonstrate, when we delete KLF4, you have a reduction in red cells, i.e. podocytes. But the expression of that red marker did not co-localize with a marker of pariepithelial cells, thereby demonstrating that there's some kind of signaling that's occurring that triggers these pariepithelial cell activation. Now, work from a number of laboratories have shown that not all pariepithelial cells are the same, depending on the origin of the location of pariepithelial cells along the basement membrane, as well as some serving a physiological role in this setting. So in a pseudocrescent formation where you don't have necessarily fibrin deposition or significant inflammatory cells due to a lack of basement membrane rupture, here primarily it's activation of epithelial cells. There's been long debated before that could potentially these are podocytes that have proliferating, but our lineage tracing studies demonstrate that these are primarily pariepithelial cells that have been activated due to an ensuing loss of podocytes. So clearly a potential crosstalk or signaling that's occurring between the injured podocytes or a podocytes about to die to the neighboring pariepithelial cells to get activated potentially as a physiological response to help prevent to seal the basement membrane.
Yeah, and you know, look at the figures from that paper. It was quite clear. It's not even a question. I mean, there are no podocyte markers in this lineage tracing, which is a really good model for understanding like where a cell came from. So that's very interesting. Well, let's move on to this study here. And these mice, really interesting. They die fairly young age and they develop a pretty aggressive kidney lesion with crescents spontaneously when deleting KLF4 from podocytes. Tell us about this paper and what you did to try to understand the pathogenesis and reverse this phenotype.
One of the larger questions that we had is in vitro experiments, we had shown that the negative effects of loss of KLF4 and podocytes appeared to be primarily due to activation of phospho-STAT3 signaling. Now, we had not up until now in this paper demonstrated how much of this signaling pathway is restricted to the podocyte. So in a number of injury models to the podocytes, including deletion of KLF4 and podocytes, as well as in human kidney biopsies with focal segmental glomerulosclerosis or crescentic glomerulonephritis, you have activation of phospho-STAT3 signaling or STAT3 signaling, as well as a loss of KLF4 in the glomeruli. However, you have activation of phospho-STAT3 signaling in a number of cell types in the kidney, including encroaching inflammatory cells, as well as injured proximal tubular cells, as well as a myofibroblast or interstitial fibroblast. So one question we had was how much of the signaling between KLF4 and STAT3 is restricted to the podocyte as compared to other cell types in the kidney. And that formed the basis of the work. So therefore, we deleted STAT3 in podocytes concurrently with the KLF4 knockout to show that the large phenotype that occurs not just in podocyte injury and loss and glomerulosclerosis, but also the tubular interstitial injury and fibrosis that ensues is contingent upon the signaling pathway that's kept in check in the
podocyte. I think that's really a fascinating approach because, as you mentioned, you have all these other cells that are entering into the equation here. It's not just podocyte, but it's the parietal epithelial cells, it's inflammatory cells, probably other cells like endothelial cells that are involved here. And I always like to see get to the root cause, not the Band-Aid, or like what maybe you can change. And here it's pretty much a black and white story here, night and day. What happened?
To explain the results, which was a bit surprising, is that concurrent deletion of STAT3 and KLF4 not only prevented podocyte injury and loss, as well as subsequent proteinuria and other effects, detrimental effects to the glomerulus, but you saw a beneficial effect to the tubular interstitial compartment. And there was remarkably working with our collaborators and our kidney pathologists suggesting that the phenotype was largely resembling close to the litter mate controls or the controls. Therefore, this suggests that the effects of podocyte loss in human FSGS potentially or in crescentic glomerulonephritis or other glomerulonephritis models largely occurs as a result of detrimental podocyte health or podocyte loss in this setting. And part could be related to this KLF4 STAT3 signal.
That's fascinating to even look at the data. It's basically recapitulation of the control or wild type scenario. Doing research for a while, you rarely see that. And maybe if we can take a step back, and I know that your group has blocked STAT3 globally with inhibitor. What did that study look like compared to this?
So that's a really good question. And it's referencing work in Science Advances. And we took these mice, KLF4 knockout mice, and we treated with a STAT3 inhibitor called S3I201. which targets the SH2 domain of phospho-STAT3 and prevents its transcriptional activity in regulating downstream gene expression. So we treated these mice, as well as the control mice, with the inhibitor approximately 7 to 8 weeks of age for a 2-week period. And it showed an improvement in not just podocyte health and glomerulosclerosis, but this was more of a reversal study. We did a short-term treatment showing an improvement versus compared to this paper, where this is a genetic deletion specifically to podocytes occurring much earlier in the process. So the improvement is there with the inhibitor, not to the effect in here, because the treatments were started much later after the disease has initiated.
Right. So in this genetic study that we're talking about in the JASN paper, really hadn't had any podocyte injury at all potentially. Whereas in the inhibitor study, the global STAT3, those mice had some time for the lesion to develop and then had STAT3, and possibly maybe not quite as profound of a STAT3 block because it's a systemic drug. Is that possible as well?
Correct. And it's going to have a number of targets and has to actually get to the podocyte, and that could have an effect as well. And so I think number of factors. So I think the premise of this study was really to really show the cell specificity of STAT3 inhibition and perhaps lend for future studies to see how we can optimize a STAT3 inhibitor that can target the kidney as well.
Let's move on, because the pathology is pretty clear. They don't have any. They also live, where it's interesting, and looks like about 15 weeks, more than half of the mice have died with the KLF4 podocyte knockout alone. However, in the ones that have the STAT3 podocyte knockout and glutamate controls, they have a normal lifespan, which is fascinating as well. So maybe we can sort of move on to some of the information I think is really intriguing, is how are we going to potentially use this information to treat human kidney disease? And you have some intriguing studies to kind of probe at that.
One approach that we took is, and that was additive to what we had published before in JCI Insight, to set the stage, the paper in JCI Insight, where we showed the mechanism, but also we took kidney biopsies with crescents from crescentic glomerulonephritis, as well as collapsing FSGS, where you have pseudocrescent formation. And we conducted immunohistochemistry as well as immunofluorescence for Krupa-like factor 4, KLF4, and phospho-STAT3. And one of the earlier demonstrations to show is that in glomeruli, where there's a decrease in KLF4, you have high phospho-STAT3 activation. And in glomeruli where you have high KLF4, you have low phospho-STAT3 activation, as well as less crescent formation and pyroepithelial cell formation. So they clearly have an inverse relationship. So in this study, we reviewed the NephroSeq database developed from University of Michigan, where you have a conglomerate of studies conducted with bulk RNA sequencing from isolated glomeruli in patients with human glomerular diseases. That includes diabetic kidney disease to lupus nephritis to focal segmental glomerulosclerosis, as well as renal vasculitis. And we interrogated the database for downstream markers of STAT3 activation, downstream targets of STAT3 activation. And what we observed is that there was a high enrichment of downstream STAT3 signaling in kidney biopsies that had renal vasculitis, i.e. with crescentic glomerulonephritis, as well as in lupus nephritis, and in some patients with also some markers were activated in diabetic kidney disease, which has been reported before. We also showed that downstream activation of STAT3 signaling inversely correlated with eGFR, meaning higher the STAT3 activation, the lower the eGFR. Finally, we took our previously reported single-cell sequencing data from KLF4 knockout mice and we conducted deconvolution analysis using bulk RNA sequencing from Neptune database that has human FSGS samples to demonstrate that the enrichment of phospho-STAT3 signaling primarily resides in the podocyte.
I think it's a very important step where you took what has previously been known for the mouse models that your group looked at and really showed that in human diseases, many of which do have propensity to have crescent formation, have a high STAT3, at least downstream gene targets that are upregulated, and these seem to be enriched in podocytes. And so I think this is a really important step. So I guess the next question is, do you think there's potential to take this to humans and treat them with an inhibitor of STAT3?
The answer lies in whether we could use our ability to identify an expression of phospho-STAT3 in kidney biopsies in human glomerular diseases to utilize potentially a personalized approach to, say, in individuals or in kidney biopsies with high phospho-STAT3 activation, potentially those are the individuals that could benefit from inhibition of that signaling pathway, rather than applying it to all human glomerular diseases. So really targeting those kidney biopsies that have an activation. Now we have the ability to measure the amount as well as activation of phospho-STAT3. And so then we could say when those individuals, we should be potentially utilizing a STAT3 inhibitor.
So basically it would be like a precision medicine, like when you do the kidney biopsy, stain for STAT3, it's elevated, consider a STAT3 inhibitor. That could be, if you can show that it works in humans that way, a potential therapeutic option.
Correct. And I think it's in a very exciting time now because there are a number of investigational STAT3 inhibitors, some very targeted, utilized for not just cancer treatments, but also for autoimmune diseases that are in clinical trials. And there's a potential whether they could be repurposed for conditions of high STAT3 activation in human glomerular diseases.
What diseases are they currently being used in the rheumatology world? And had there been any thoughts to just look to see how often they get kidney disease?
My understanding, currently they're being used for rheumatoid arthritis and others, which are much more broader agents that target the ligands that are involved in activation of STAT3 signaling. So those are the ones that are the much more precision STAT3 inhibitors are being primarily used for T-cell lymphomas and potentially even hepatocellular carcinoma, solid tumors, as well as liquid tumors.
Well, this is a wonderful study, and congratulations to you and your group for really pushing the envelope on this important area and also answering fundamental questions about the origin of crescents, which I think is really fascinating.
Thank you for the opportunity to present some of our work, and really enjoyed the conversation.
If you were talking to a resident or a first-year fellow that had an interest in bench research, what kind of advice would you tell them, and what does the future of research look like in nephrology?
Perhaps maybe I can answer this by what I was told when I was in their shoes in my clinical training. The opportunity to engage in research is perhaps one of the most important things that we could do as clinicians, because it enables us to really understand what are the fundamental mechanisms that are driving a disease process and how our current therapeutics or the way we manage can fundamentally shift with what we do in the laboratory. I recognize that these are challenging times these days with funding, the interest potentially in fields where we can really engage in discovery from our trainees. But I would take a step back and say that the part that makes medicine exciting in my mind is really discovery and how that will impact patient care down the road. Almost every discovery that we have made in medicine is dependent on fundamental discoveries in the laboratory.
Listening to you and the work that you're doing really energized me for sure. And I would definitely sign up to get involved in your lab for sure. These are some really important questions, and Congratulations again, and also for inspiring the next generation. Thank you so much. And I'm joined today by Dr. Isa Schmidt, and we're here to discuss the association of foot process effacement with kidney histopathologic lesions and disease progression. Welcome to ASN Kidney Translation.
Hi, my name is Isa Schmidt, and I'm an assistant professor of medicine at Boston University and Boston Medical Center. I'm happy to join this podcast today to discuss our recent paper on assessment of podocyte in a biopsy cohort of patients, assess risk of disease progression in patients with CKD.
Foot process effacement, something we always see on our pathologic report. Oftentimes, it's in a disease that you expect to see it, like diabetes or minimal change disease. But sometimes it appears in places you just would not expect. And I really enjoyed reading this paper because sometimes you don't know what to do with that information or don't know how to really wrap it into the prognosis or the treatment for the patient. So tell us about how this all started and where you got to this paper.
Where we set out was in simple terms that kidney diseases are so highly variable, and it's often very difficult for clinicians to predict which patient will progress to kidney failure. And since podocyte injury is very central forms of kidney damage, we were really interested in testing whether foot process effacement, which is a very well established and very well known marker of podocyte injury that is already reported on every kidney biopsy report, could we use that across different diagnoses underlying the disease? Could we use it as a marker to the risk of disease progression? And maybe could we even also learn more about, are there any associations between foot process effacement and other lesions that we see on kidney biopsies? And so we had access to a kidney biopsy cohort where we were able to study this in kind of a larger population of patients with CKD who all underwent a kidney biopsy.
How well do pathologists quantify foot process effacement? Do they have a standard rubric they all follow, or does every pathologist have their own sort of way to do it?
Excellent point, and it's something that we added to the discussion and conclusion of our paper. I think at the moment it is reported, and when we went through all of the EM reports in our cohort, we found certain patterns that they are usually described in a specific way. But as far as I know, there is not really a standardized assessment used by pathologists across the world to routinely describe FPE on biopsy reports. And I think our paper highlights that it might actually be a really useful tool to have, not only for pathologists, but also for clinicians as well as researchers, to have more standardized assessments, for example, of FPE or even of other ultrastructural markers that could enhance our assessment of a patient and ultimately improve prognostic models as well.
One of the pathologic findings that seemed across many different diseases is interstitial fibrosis. So I'm curious as to what the thought process was to, what is the gold standard? Is it interstitial fibrosis?
So FPE, or which is the short term for foot process effacement, is one of the earliest and common morphologic manifestations of podocyte injury. And is usually characterized by swelling, retraction, and then buckling of podocyte pedicles, which can lead to the podocytes losing their interdigitating pattern. I think in this paper, we expected to see strong associations between FPE, or foot process effacement, and downstream glomerular lesions, including segmental sclerosis or glomerular sclerosis. And you pointed out that what we did find was a strong association with IFTA. And so IFTA itself, which is short for interstitial fibrosis and tubular atrophy, is, I think, used as an overall marker to assess how fibrosed a kidney is, and is a strong independent predictor of future kidney failure. We do think the reasons why we might have seen this association between foot process effacement and IFTA is because the crosstalk between the glomerulus and the tubules may not have been studied in a way that will highlight how important their interaction is. And potentially down the road, while albuminuria and FPE affect the kidney, it becomes more and more fibrotic. And so that's where we presumably see this association pointing more towards the tubules, even though we started out with something that would affect the glomerulus more than the tubules.
So you can tell us about that cohort, how many patients you had, and how you assess for foot process effacement.
We were fortunate enough to have access to a fairly large biopsy cohort. So the Boston Kidney Biopsy cohort is a cohort of patients who all underwent a clinically indicated native kidney biopsy. And patients were recruited at 3 academic hospitals in Boston. And what we did is, as soon as a patient got enrolled, we collected blood and urine, and for some also DNA. And then we had 2 kidney pathologists to score the biopsies. And they provided us with a semi-quantitative assessment of all histopathologic lesions that they routinely look at when they evaluate a kidney biopsy. And then we also had all electron microscopy, or in short, EM reports from patients. And these were available for this study in 813 patients. And so looking at the EM reports, we went back and met in sessions with a kidney pathologist to provide us with a score that would describe the foot process effacement, how it's been reported on the EM report. And so once we had turned this into a semi-quantitative assessment, we were able to include it in our statistical models and then test for associations with future kidney failure and pathologic lesions.
So these are 813 patients from multiple different centers. However, interestingly, the pathologists were the same 2 that read all 813. It wasn't like you were just getting the reports from their institution. Is that correct?
Yes. So we do have the report. So the EM reports were taken from each institution, but the histopathologic lesion, including glomerular lesions, if and ones that are included in this paper, those were scored by 2 kidney pathologists. I want to say all of these hospitals are under the umbrella of Harvard Medical School, which made it easier to have the same 2 pathologists to look at the slides and provide an assessment of them.
What is the percent of biopsies entered into the cohort? Is there a certain, just the patient had to consent for it, or are these like all comers?
So basically the inclusion criteria of this cohort were undergoing a native kidney biopsy and then not being enrolled in any other competing studies, no pregnancy. Every patient who did undergo for clinical indication a biopsy was eligible. So it is a very broad range of diagnoses covered in this cohort.
Now let's go ahead and move to table 1. And what are the baseline characteristics of this cohort of 813 patients?
The mean age in our cohort was approximately 51 years. And the mean eGFR, which is important for our analysis, was about 58. And then the median albuminuria was around 993 milligrams per gram creatinine. And so as discussed, we did include various clinical pathologic diagnoses. So we have still a slight overrepresentation of glomerular diseases. So we included patients with proliferative and non-proliferative glomerulopathies. We also included patients with a diagnosis of advanced chronic changes, then patients with primary underlying vascular disease, diabetic nephropathy, and tubular interstitial disease. So in terms of foot process effacement across the entire cohort, we had about 6% of participants who really had no foot process effacement or FPE on biopsy. We had 50% that had mild FPE, and then 15 and 29 respectively had moderate and severe FPE.
So just a very small portion, 10% with no foot process effacement. That's interesting. The other thing to note is the GFR was fairly preserved in these, and I guess the other thing I was just thinking about is that we typically don't biopsy individuals that have fairly advanced disease, at least based upon creatinine trajectory. When I look at research studies, you want to have a broad representation of diseases. And since we only biopsy people in a certain range of kidney function, I wonder if it's hard to get some of those very severe cases. For instance, the GFR was 60.
Yes.
A lot of these people had an active nephrotic syndrome with preserved kidney function. But if you had someone that had very advanced disease, they wouldn't be included.
Exactly. I do think this is something that is also probably important as we interpret the associations that we see in the paper. I think that the composition of the cohort is an important factor here, as well as the timing of biopsy. So we did see an association between foot process effacement and mesangial expansion, as well as interstitial fibrosis and tubular atrophy. And some of this might be explained by the composition of the cohort and the timing. I believe that the patients with suspected glomerular disease that we included in our cohort typically biopsied very early in the disease course, when things like glomerular sclerosis may not yet be very pronounced, but you might already see a good amount of mesangial expansion. But then what we also included were patients with diabetic kidney disease, and these tend to undergo biopsy later in the disease course. And those will also probably be the ones and may have driven the effect we see or the association with kidney failure, because they often then have more pronounced CKD already when they get biopsied.
So I guess we can start with figure one that just sort of looks at the buckets of kidney disease, which you can go through, and how much foot process effacements you were seeing across those.
So what we do see in the paper in figure one is that individuals with more severe foot process effacement do not exhibit significant difference in eGFR compared to those with lower severity of foot process effacement. But we do also see that more severe FPE is correlating with significantly increased levels of albuminuria. And so that is shown in figure 1A, which is what we very much expected. We also see in figure 1B then the breakdown of these FPE or foot process effacement severity by the clinical pathologic diagnosis. And here you may appreciate that across all diagnoses, there is foot process effacement that we saw as reported on the electromicroscopy report. And so even in diagnoses where we would not expect to see the glomerulus be affected as the primary target, we do see foot process effacement. We do see the most severe foot process effacement in those with glomerulopathies, but even in those with a primary tubular interstitial disease, there are cases that have severe foot process effacement. So that kind of supported our overall hypothesis that FPE might be an important marker to be studied across different kidney disease diagnoses.
Yeah, definitely you're struck by that every really disease can have foot process effacement, including vascular and tubular interstitial diseases. Oftentimes you think, well, maybe there's something else going on. And I was curious, do you have any individuals that did have a glomerular and tubular interstitial process combined, and how you dealt with those in this paper?
Yeah, that is hard to distinguish in our cohort because we do have the assessment of the primary clinical pathologic diagnosis. So if they had secondary, like severe tubular interstitial damage, we would only get that information from looking at the actual biopsy, but we do not have it basically assessed to be included in our statistical model. So that would be a limitation, as this is certainly a possibility where you have a big overlap of both.
Well, how well did it do in predicting kidney failure?
So we did see a pretty strong association of moderate or severe foot process effacement, as documented in the EM report, with future kidney failure. So it was associated with a 2.7-fold higher risk of kidney failure compared to non or mild foot process effacement. And what we also looked at was that relationship between foot process effacement and kidney failure. Could we better understand this looking at the different pathways that lead from effacement to kidney failure? And so to do that, we used mediation analysis, and we were actually able to see that foot process effacement contributed to disease progression both directly and indirectly, meaning there are effects of FPE that are mediated through albuminuria, and it is a significant proportion, but there are also other effects that we may need to better understand down the road using experimental models.
What other things would you like readers to know about this study in helping them care for patients with kidney disease?
So I think overall, there is research from prior studies that showed that foot process effacement is a very important prognostic marker in specific conditions, ranging from lupus nephritis or IgA nephropathy, What I do think our work extends on is that these findings are useful for a broader spectrum of kidney diseases, and that food process effacement may be a general marker of disease severity and prognosis, and useful for clinicians to provide a better risk assessment for patients once they are able to access the biopsy reports. And an additional takeaway, I think, from this paper would be that there is need for standardized reporting of FPE, because I do think this paper suggests that FPE and maybe even additional ultrastructural markers can actually improve prognostic models, and that may lead to better personalized care or even guide interventions in kidney disease if we can integrate them into our prognostic assessments.
Well, first, congratulations to you and your group on a fantastic contribution to the glomerular disease literature. What are the next steps?
So I think specifically for this study, we would love to validate these findings in additional patient cohorts, and then also emphasize the need to develop, again, standardized quantitative ways to report food process effacement. So I think more broadly, the field should integrate ultrastructural biomarkers like food process effacement into prognostic models alongside molecular and clinical markers, which I think will really be important to better personalize care and then guide targeted interventions in patients. And so these are kind of the next steps that after validation in additional cohorts, we will work closely with pathologists to improve the report and the integration of these ultrastructural markers into our prognostic models.
Thank you so much for joining us on the ASN Kidney Translation Podcast. And also thank you to our listeners for joining us. Tune in for the next episode of the ASN Kidney Translation Podcast.
This podcast is copyrighted by the American Society of Nephrology. All rights reserved. All content in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be medical advice. This podcast should not be used in a medical emergency or for the diagnosis or treatment of any medical condition. Please consult your doctor or other qualified healthcare professional if you have any questions about any medical condition or before taking any drug, changing your diet, or commencing or discontinuing any course of treatment. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the American Society of Nephrology.